Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of Flip the Focus. I'm Jen Dobby and I'm the creative director at Hotwire Australia. In my role as a tech sticky beak, I have been lucky enough to host now a whole first season of Flip the Focus. And throughout that season, I've spoken to some extraordinary women who are funding, founding and leading tech-based businesses. And they're really at the forefront of some of the biggest questions in society at the moment, and using tech to change our world for the better and to answer those questions in a fair and equitable way. Now, as you can imagine, putting together a podcast series like Flip the Focus takes lots of research and lots of investigation. And one of the things that kept crossing my mind during the time I was doing this research was, what did all the extraordinary women who came before us, before all of us involved in this series, do to achieve the extraordinary things that they achieved without the tech that we have access to? And that felt like a really fascinating question to me. It also occurred to me that I was lucky enough to have access to talk to one of those women and ask her those questions. And the woman in question is Commandant Anthea Larkin. Now, Anthea Larkin joined the Women's Royal Naval Service, commonly known as the WRENS, in 1956. What's really interesting about Anthea's career trajectory is that throughout it, she used what was at the time cutting-edge tech in a number of different roles, from photography through to the Military Agency for Standardization in NATO, and then Chief Services Officer at Devonport, and then in the Royal College of Defence. She then became director of WRENS between the late 80s and the early 90s, and she was also aide-de-camp to the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II. Pretty extraordinary, right? Pretty extraordinary career. Now, the reason that I'm lucky enough to be able to just call up this person on a whim and talk to them about how they use tech and how they achieve these extraordinary things in their career is that Anthea is my aunt. And so when I was back in the UK earlier on this year, I found the time to sit down with her and she kindly agreed to talk to us about how you worked for equitable solutions to really extraordinary and tricky problems in an era where you didn't have access to the tech that we have now. What was the tech that was available at those time in that times, and what did she do with it? So let's get into it and flip the focus with Commandant Anthea Larkin.
Hi, Jen.
A lot of our listeners won't know the purpose of the WRENS in the first place. So take us back and tell us a bit about why did the WRENS exist? And, you know, these days, as you can imagine, with a more modern female lens, seems odd that you'd have a ladies' bit and a men's bit of the Navy. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, of course, the WRENS started in 1917 and was started by our first director was Dame Catherine Furze, and the Navy had been persuaded that because they needed to send more men to sea, that they had needed other people in uniform to do the jobs, that it would be right to put women in uniform to do the jobs that were going to be to release a man to go to sea.
Like what? What were some of those jobs that they would have started off doing?
Okay, well, communications, particularly, all forms of administration, because you always have on board, and we're talking Navy now, so we always have administrators on board doing logistics, that sort of thing. So supply, ammunition, all that sort of thing. Getting that on board, not actually using it. And so that was the need of the WRENS. And they stayed formed until 1920, when they were disbanded, because there was never going to be another war. Then in 1939, they came back again.
But then what I find interesting is, and maybe you have an opinion on this, having been in the service, why then, after the First World War, when we've discovered, oh, actually, these chapesses are very good at doing these things, why did they not carry on doing those things and you have a combined force?
One needs services in peacetime,
right,
to keep the peace. And unfortunately, as has been seen time and time again, the services are run down and then suddenly they're needed again. They wanted men to do them because men would do them and they would then go on board ship.
Right, so they could do both. Okay, whereas the women weren't allowed on ship at that time.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
But then come the Second World War, the role of the Wrens was increased enormously in the number of jobs that they did. And, I mean, there were something like 85,000.
Wow.
At the peak time, women in during the Second World War who were doing all sorts of jobs, a great variety. The job that I did when I immediately joined the Wrens in 1956 was as a range assessor, but there had been, in the war, there were bomb range markers and cine assessors, so it was an amalgam of those two things.
What are they?
That I did. Well, this was when a pilot learns to fly an aircraft. So he's first of all got to learn to manhandle the machine. He, or now she, of course, has to learn to fight the aircraft. So they've got to learn to do, if they're fighters, air-to-air combat, and some air-to-ground combat, of course, but a lot of it is air-to-air combat. But then there's the, what we used to call the bombers rather than the fighters, who drop bombs, and then there's firing rockets, that sort of thing. So they've got to learn to do all that with a pinpoint precision.
And so how did your role help with that?
Well, we used to, the pilots would fly their aircraft, switch on, so the fighters switch on their cameras, and the camera would act as the gun. So the camera would film what the gun would have done, and it then came back to us, and we were able to put it through a put it onto a board and assess how near they would have got.
Okay. And so if we think about this from those two angles that we've talked about, firstly, your use of, or your solving of problems and your provision of information and expertise without technology. And then the second thing we've talked about is the things that you have done in your career which have paved the way for what women are doing now, or what the Navy more generally is doing now. So spoiler alert, we know where you ended up, which was right at the very top. So how does somebody who starts with admin and starts with range assessing and photography assessment, what came next? Did you know at that point that you were there, you wanted to spend your whole career in the Wrens? Did you know then?
No, I don't think I ever knew I wanted it, but it just happened. But I mean, the key job, I suppose, which I did in the middle of my career, was to go and be to the Wren officer training moved from the Royal Naval College at Greenwich to Dartmouth. So this was really the first of three steps which put women's training and, first of all, the training, and then put the women more on a par with the men.
So is that, does that mean, break that down for us a bit. Is that the same training that the men were having at Dartmouth?
No.
While you moved?
No, we had a separate course. And the same time, we still had the same, the way the Wrens came in. So they didn't come to Dartmouth as new people. They didn't come off the street to Dartmouth. They came having done at least 6 months and most of them more than that, most of them having done at least one job, if not two or three. So they came, they did a 3-month course at Dartmouth, which was similar, but slightly changed to become Wren officers, and they would leave Dartmouth as third officers. The other step was to move, or the other major step was to move the Wren's basic training from where we used to do it at HMS at Burfield near Reading, HMS Dauntless, down to HMS Raleigh in Cornwall, where the men train.
Let's talk a little bit about the technology that happened then. So this was training. You were training Wrens, and they've come in one end having, so they're Wrens already, they've done one job, then they've come in to train as officers. So what form does that training take, or did that training take at that time?
Well, it was teaching them about the Navy, the sort of jobs and the sort of things that they need to know far more general than they had done before, because they'd only really known before, unless they were very observant, about their own specific job. They needed to know much more generally about the Navy and how it ran.
And so was it a bit like any form of academia then, sort of very paper-based learning and classroom learning?
Oh, quite a lot of that, but also quite a lot of, they did a certain amount of sea training. They also did a certain amount of leadership training.
So then if we look at the movement of the Wrens, we've gone from where they started out, which was really, you know, the men aren't here to do this because they've gone off to war, but we need these things done so the women can do them. But the whole mindset then has shifted towards, well, actually, we're going to start giving them really similar training in that way. Is
well,
that right?
Yes, but the background is that society is changing. So, and the services are a reflection of society. Probably more healthy, but basically they are a reflection of society. And so women were joining, and they were, a lot of them were wanting to do more demanding jobs and were absolutely capable of doing more demanding jobs. They always had been. It was just a question of giving them the job to do it. But the brick wall came up, lack of sea experience all the time. In fact, I then did a job which my first task in this job was to write a paper on the future of employment of the Wrens. And as part of that, I visited Canada, where they already served at sea. I spoke with Norwegians and in particular with the Netherlands, because they very much served at sea, and with the Americans. Because although they were not at sea in naval ships, they were at sea in what we call the auxiliaries, the Royal Fleet auxiliaries, in the supporting ships, and indeed were already commanding them. This was the early 80s.
I would have been very little, sort of one or two, and you were busy going round all these different places and interviewing different navies who already had women at sea. So when you came into that role, was it, I just want to understand the background of that role. When you delivered your paper, was it bombshell paper, good Lord, Anthea thinks we should go to sea, or was it, look, these other people are doing it, so you should go and, you know, find a sensible way of saying we should do it too? Like, what was the landscape?
The reaction was not good.
Right.
So basically it was, I was told there was plenty of scope for employment, but nobody could actually tell me what there was, because there wasn't anything. Plenty of scope for employment, or not plenty, but, you know, enough for additional employment for women. And there was no need for them to go to sea. Yes. Although actually a previous director had already started the ball rolling because she knew this was the name's Mary Talbot, who knew that that was what would happen, that women would go to sea eventually. But it was a matter of planning for it. So we had the move to Dartmouth, the move to Raleigh, and coming under the Naval Discipline Act. So that did away with being run as a separate service. We were then far more part of the Navy, and the Director Wrens became much more of a figurehead rather than somebody who was in charge of and responsible for.
Can we talk about that time? Because it's so interesting to me that those, you know, what seems with a modern eye and a modern ear like a ridiculous and obvious contradiction or, you know, or dichotomy, but there's lots of opportunity for women in the Navy without going out in a boat. You know, that seems so blindingly obvious now.
Well, no, that...
What was the conversation at the time?
Well, the conversation specifically for the Navy, well, the conversation for all the three services is that it was said by the National Audit Office that if you don't do the main job of the service, you don't need to be in uniform. Now, the Army and the Air Force have a lot of grey area because not, in fact, relatively few people fly aircraft, but they need an enormous amount of support.
You have said there were a number of different things that happened, the training at Dartmouth, but what point, where was the momentum, and was this when you were commandant or was this the role before? Where was the momentum in women being able to go to sea? Had a number of these things already happened and you pulled it together?
No.
Or was there still way aggressively against that?
No. I think you gave me much too much of a role in this going to sea. There was a major paper written shortly after I took over the job of Director Wrens about the future of the Women's Royal Naval Service. I think the nice thing to say about it is, did not come to any firm conclusions, but it did say that women were perfectly capable of going to sea, or would be perfectly capable of going to sea, and there was a lot of talk about it, but the government by this time, because the Navy was very short of people, it was having problems retaining people, and one of the major categories that it was short of was communicators. And, of course, the women were very good at this. And anyway, the long and short of it is that the Navy Board eventually was persuaded that it would be right to send women to sea. And the announcement was made at the end of January 1990. And in October that year, the first women went to sea, properly trained, ready to go.
That's amazing. Yeah, and I remember at the time, we were on the radio talking about that, the women going to sea. I guess there's two questions then. The first part being, how did it change the experience or the, you know, the mood in the Wrens for the people who were already there? And then the second part being, did it do what you needed it to do for people coming into the Wrens?
Yes, I think for those who were already there, there was clearly an enormous sadness. And for the Association of Wrens, so for those who had served in the Wrens previously, people were very sad, and understandably so, because you, if you've got a good thing, you don't want to change it. But it had reached its sell-by date. The future was, and this is what the women, the majority of women who were joining from today's, or the then today's society, wanted.
Just to join the Navy.
And so there was, yes, there was sadness, but on the other hand, there was a lot of excitement too amongst those who actually transferred. And took the great step to move into eventually becoming being able to go to sea.
Ocean-going roles,
indeed, yes, absolutely. So that part was quite a lot of excitement. And then, of course, the big announcement came. There was, as a result of the big announcement, recruiting changed. And so we knew that anybody who joined as from the 1st of September 1990, they had up to then, otherwise they joined the Wrens and didn't have to go to sea, but anybody who joined the Wrens as from the 1st of September 1990 would be trained to go to sea.
Mm. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And so from a training standpoint, if we go back to the beginning of our journey today, we were talking about how during both the wars and when the Wrens service was started, really a lot of the role was around the technology of communications and logistics. So, you know, we fast forward to the 1990s when women are at sea. Do the roles, you know, we would hope that the roles become kind of automatically even across the sexes. Is that the case? Were they trained in exactly the same way?
Yeah. All the roles are evenly split.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. They do. Everything is mixed. And so according to the number of women that there are, because they try to have, I think it's at least 10% women on board. So there are women on board practically every ship, and of course on board submarines too. And a woman is just about or has just taken over command of an aircraft carrier.
In terms of numbers, so ratios, is the Navy, you know, you said 10% of women on board, or 10% women on board, what are the ratios like in the Navy in terms of gender?
I think the numbers, it is smaller than the Navy would wish. It is about 10 to 15%.
Female. I know you can't talk to what happens now at sea, but was it your experience that women and men are treated equitably in the Navy?
No, they weren't. I'm sure they... And to a certain extent, they probably aren't now, because there aren't enough women around still in senior roles to be more pervasive, if you like. There's still the male attitude.
And do you think it's a bit of a vicious cycle if you don't have enough women?
No, I think steps are being taken, and I think it will change, but it takes time. And although women have been at sea now for 30 years, and so we've grown through, and as I said, we've got a number of commanding officers who've done extremely well. Yes, it takes time. It takes time, I'm afraid, and still there are pockets. But it, again, I say, it is a reflection of society.
Sure.
You can't just change things. One would like to think that the services in that sort of respect would be leaders of society. And, I mean, I can only really talk with experience about the Navy and the sort of people who come into the Navy now. So, you know, most of them are intelligent enough to be able to, you know, be in the sort of roles that are equitable and to treat each other as human beings and treat each other properly.
Do you think that you said when I asked you if people were treated equitably, you said no, they weren't. What do you think helped you to progress right to the top? What did you have a very specific attitude, or do you think some of it was luck, or what do you think helped you get what
you... Well, of course, I wasn't competing against men. I was competing against women.
Sure.
But I was doing unusual jobs, or mostly fairly unusual jobs for women. So I...
Were you the only woman in a lot of...
The only woman
in a lot of the roles you did?
Now, I was never the only woman around, because there are always others somewhere. But I was the first on one or two occasions, yes. And I think you've just got to sort of do your best for... I mean, Dartmouth, I suppose, is really a case in point. I had a very good second-in-command, Liz McComb, and together, and we did do it together too, because you had to, we pushed through what we wanted and or what we needed to make the thing successful. I mean, to say about not being treated equally there, that is, we were treated absolutely equally, absolutely equally. The captain at the time would not have had it any other way.
And that's interesting, because that's also, you know, a reflection of an individual, isn't it? A particular person running that.
But but then that goes through life, doesn't it, really? If you look at who runs things and successful businesses, you know, a lot depends upon the individual who's at the top.
I think it's interesting. One of the things that you said that I think it's very interesting to delve into is I asked you how you got where you got, and you said very quickly that you were not competing against men, it was only other women. And I think that says something so interesting about you as a person. But I'm also interested to know that, do you think that if you had been competing against men, you would have got there anyway? Do you think if there were men and women?
Oh, the whole thing would have been entirely different. Entirely different. And I was of my age and society, and that was not society. Today, it is much harder for the women, because there are fewer of them, and because they've always got to be better.
Yeah, and that what's so interesting, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you for the podcast was that exact point that you just made, which is women have to be better when they're competing against men. They're not judged equally. I've talked to lots of different women for this series so far, but they've all said really similar things, which is even when it's an even playing field, it's not an even playing field.
No.
So I can understand, aside from the going to see or not going to see, I can also understand why some of the women in the Wrens might have been really upset about it disappearing.
Oh, well, obviously there were some people who were very upset, some people who didn't think women should have gone to sea at all. But when you say, well, do you let it wither on the vine? And they don't have an answer for that, of course.
Well, no, because I think, you know, the conversation we're getting into now is really interesting, because the facts are the facts, you know, and you had everything in front of you, so you knew. You know, it's evolve or die. And that's, you know, often, I mean, if we look at technology and the conversations we've been having around AI, for example, that's where we are now. It's evolve or die.
I think the other thing is, I grew up in an era when we used telephones to speak to each other, but we actually met. We didn't use Zoom, because there wasn't Zoom, or we didn't do things remotely. And while clearly there are great advantages in this, and particularly if you're talking worldwide and that sort of thing, nothing beats being in the same room as somebody else when you're talking to them to gauge how they're taking what you say or how reacting.
But that's the irony of modern technology.
It is a tool, and it is being allowed to become all-pervasive and actually take over, rather than we being the servant to the tool, to what is the tool. And I think that is, well, somebody's going to have to grab it back.
I think that there's certainly an argument to be had that we've potentially tipped over the edge, just sharing everything all the time, and it's too much. Well, look, I'm going to say thank you so much for talking to us today, Anthea. And it's really been fascinating to hear your story and how you were able to go places that other women hadn't been. So lots of women could come after you and do fun and amazing things. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much for listening to our special bonus episode of Flip the Focus, Before the Tech. I really hope that you enjoyed it. That's the end of this season of Flip the Focus, season one. And I'm so excited to confirm that we are going ahead with season two, and we'll be bringing it to you early in the new year in 2025. So keep your ears peeled, listen out for more amazing stories of the women behind the tech. And I look forward to talking to you then.